This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, the winter holidays are approaching, which often means a lot of social gatherings that include alcohol. Our guest has advice on how to attend those social gatherings with confidence if you're staying sober, and how to host and include people who opt not to drink. Now, tomorrow's elections for governor and U.S. senator have gotten a lot of attention, but changes in the Wisconsin legislature could also have major impacts for state government. Republicans are within reach of winning a two-thirds majority in both houses of the legislature. That would give them the power to override vetoes from the governor. To win that supermajority, Republicans would need to flip one seat in the state Senate, five in the Assembly. Winning all those races may be a tall order, but some key seats in northwestern Wisconsin stand a good chance of changing hands. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the potential for a veto-proof Republican majority in the state capitol? Have you seen the political mood in your part of the state change in recent years? Have your local district lines changed in a way that could sway the outcome? Do you want to see this supermajority happen, or do you worry about it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Reed Epstein is a politics reporter for the New York Times, covering campaigns and elections, formerly with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. His recent piece focuses on races in northwestern Wisconsin that could be key to Republicans getting closer to that supermajority. Reed, welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to talk to you again.
Before we look at the possibility of that supermajority, can you talk about what's at stake? How much different could Wisconsin government look with that Republican supermajority?
Well, if the Republicans take two-thirds in both chambers, it really won't matter that much who wins the governor's race. A big feature of Tony Evers' administration over the last 4 years has been his vetoing of 146 bills from the Republicans in the legislature. And if Republicans take a two-thirds majority, or if Tim Michaels is elected, those bills and likely much more will come out of a Republican out of Republican control in Madison. And I think given just how politics has changed in the last couple of years since Donald Trump has been out of office and kind of what it means to be a Republican at this point, I think you would expect to see a much more aggressive posture from those legislative Republicans in Madison than you saw during the Scott Walker years.
And Wisconsin is a state, I think, known in many cases for very close statewide elections. The last couple of presidential elections have been, 1%-ish affairs. Last race for governor, for example, our polls are very close to the race for governor and U.S. Senate here, at least according to the latest polls. How is the legislature so off kilter from that?
Well, if you go, it really goes back to 2010 when Republicans in the Republican wave election during the first President Obama midterm, they won control of the legislature in Wisconsin. Scott Walker was elected governor, and a lot of people remember what came next was the Act 10 fights, where you had tens of thousands of people protesting in Madison. But what got a lot less attention at the time was the new lines that the Republicans implemented for the state legislative districts, and that really allowed Republicans to have a vice grip on majorities in the state legislature. And so those lines existed for 10 years. And then when there was a new census in 2020 and a new opportunity to draw new lines for the decade that's just starting, the Wisconsin Supreme Court ruled that because the legislature and Governor Evers couldn't agree on a set of maps, that the Supreme Court ordered that the new maps operate under a least change rule from the existing heavily gerrymandered maps. And that gave Republicans an opportunity to lock in these large majorities in a 50-50 state for another decade. And that's those new maps for the 2020s are what the candidates are running on tomorrow.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Brian is with us in Superior. Brian, hi.
I just want to make a quick point of the fact that, you guys touched on gerrymandering, but I'm kind of afraid of what Michaels came out and said in reference to if he gets in office, there's going to never be another Democrat in office. And what does that mean? More gerrymandering? More corruption? I mean, when there's a two-party system, at least we have a slight chance of checks and balances, and that's my point.
Brian, thanks for the call. Reid, I think you mentioned that particular quote in your reporting. The Michaels campaign has said he means his policies are going to be really good. People won't want to vote for Democrats. Democrats looking at that, as Brian is, though, saying it's in effect a threat that the election landscape could be changed under Republican control.
Yeah, and it's the latest in what's been a pattern with Tim Michaels, where he has said something in public and then his campaign shortly thereafter has had to sort of walk back and say that's not what he really meant. And I think what we've had to go by based on other candidates who have sort of been in this position where their campaign has had to sort of do a lot of explaining about what they meant is usually in that case, the candidate means what they say and the campaign is doing some explaining for political expedience.
Brian, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Reid Epstein from the New York Times, looking at the possibility of a Republican supermajority in the state legislature, in which case, in effect, at least when it comes to passing laws, it doesn't matter who would win the governor's race because there'd be a veto-proof majority. You can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. Reid, our caller there, Brian, was from Superior. And this is a part of the state, a northern and northwestern Wisconsin, that you have been focusing on a reporting from. Why is this area so important to this story?
Yeah, I was up there last week in Superior and Ashland and also in Bayfield County as well. It's interesting because those three counties have voted for Democrats in presidential elections in Wisconsin in every election since 1976. They have had Democratic members in the Assembly and the state Senate for even longer than that. It is a part of the state that has a lot of union members, people who worked in paper mills and at the shipyards in Superior and Duluth. And like a lot of rural parts of the country, it has been slipping toward Republicans during the Obama and Trump years, but it still has remained in the Democratic column. That is likely to change in the elections tomorrow, because now both assembly seats and the state Senate seat there, the way they have been redrawn, Donald Trump would have won all three of them. And those are key seats that help get Republicans toward the veto-proof majorities they need in both chambers. Like you said, they need five to flip five seats in the assembly. Two of them are in basically based in Superior and Ashland. The state Senate district covers the northern swath of the state all the way down to the Twin Cities and over to Rhinelander and Minocqua. And it is a part of the state that that has been Democratic, perhaps, you know, long after it should have been based on the demographics there. But once Democrats lose those seats, they become very difficult to win back. And that's what we have seen in districts that are like this, both in state legislatures and in Congress around the country, that once some of these sort of long-held Democratic areas turn, that the party does not win them back.
And you heard some from both parties on their strategies in the area. You visited with Governor Evers about this issue while he was campaigning in northern Wisconsin. What did he say about the possibility of a Republican supermajority?
Governor Evers was optimistic that they could hold on to the ability to sustain a veto in the assembly. He said the state Senate would be tougher. The other thing that the governor said was that if Democrats do lose the ability to sustain the veto, that he expressed some optimism that there would be moderate Republicans that would work with his administration to try to prevent some of the more aggressive Republican proposals from getting through. You know, that I knew when I asked him if he could name some members who he was thinking of, he declined. And so that was hard to know how much of that was wishful thinking or something that he is telling himself to try to get through the election and not look at the worst case scenario.
And then some Republicans you report in the area are saying, hey, our party's going to control the legislature. You might as well elect somebody locally who's going to be in the majority.
Right. That was the argument from the Republican Party chairman in Douglas County, which includes Superior. He said that, far northwest Wisconsin it's, you know, 6 hours from Madison. People feel like they're forgotten by the state government up there. And when you have Democrats representing the region in the state legislature, that they seem even more forgotten, because the place where governing is happening and where bills are written are in the Republican conference. And that if the Democrats have very little influence on policymaking in Madison, which he is right about that. Democrats only got hearings on 2% of the bills they introduced this last legislative session. So it's hard to argue with the idea that that if you want a real influence on how state government works and what laws are passed in Wisconsin, that you need to have a voice in the Republican conference rooms.
Let's go back to our callers. Jack is with us in Madison. Jack, hi.
Hi there. So I have a bit of a loaded question, but if you'll bear with me on this, my first part is, in light of this potential Republican supermajority, I wonder what chance down ballot Dems have getting elected in the Senate and or Assembly to hold on to the few seats we have and hopefully pick up a couple more. That way we have enough protection against Republican supermajority. And so that's part one. And then part two would be, since we have a state Supreme Court race coming up next year, assuming the liberals take control of the court and take up a case on this last round of redistricting, if that might be able to help Dems potentially pick up some more seats in further elections, I wonder just what the prospects of those trends would entail exactly.
Jack, thanks for the call. I'll refer you to a piece at WPR.org by our own Sean Johnson. Jack, who goes through some of these seats, potential Republican pickups, potential Democratic pickups, and some, not odds making, but the giving a scope of the chances. Reed, to Jack's first point, are people thinking of this as a done deal, or is this still legitimately up in the air right now?
I think the Assembly is much more up in the air than the Senate at this point. There's a number of seats that could go either way. It's a much more of a coin flip, and we'll see kind of what the electorate looks like tomorrow, how strong turnout is among both parties, and where turnout is strong too, because remember, you got to remember, like, a lot of these seats that are competitive are not seats in heavily Democratic areas, right? They're not in Milwaukee. They're not in Dane County. You know, there's a seat in Kenosha that's very competitive. There's another one in Greenfield in the Milwaukee southwest suburbs. There's another one in a couple in the Fox Valley and Beloit. And so that's kind of where this fight over the Assembly supermajority is taking place. The caller's second question is I think, a much bigger sort of atmospheric point here, is that there is a big Supreme Court race that Wisconsin will vote on in April. And if a liberal candidate wins, I've already been hearing Democrats in Wisconsin talking about how quickly they can bring cases to force a new legislative map, to force a change to the state's abortion law that prohibits virtually all abortions in the state. And so those are things that people are sort of fantasizing about doing if they can win the Supreme Court case. But you have to remember, if Republicans are in control, if either Tim Michaels wins or there's a supermajority, Republicans have talked about changing the election law on day one, come January. And it's not out of the realm of possibility that there could be a whole new system of voting, if it's passed in January, enacted in time for that April election, that would impact how people vote in that Supreme Court race.
Thanks for that call, Jack. We're talking to New York Times politics reporter Reed Epstein about the potential for a veto-proof Republican majority in the Wisconsin legislature. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you hoping this happens? Are you worried it could happen? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Reed Epstein, politics reporter for the New York Times, looking at the possibility of a Republican veto-proof majority in the Wisconsin legislature. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Reed, before we go back to our callers, how unique is Wisconsin in terms of being a fairly evenly politically divided state that has a potential for one party to have this veto-proof supermajority in its legislature?
It's rare, but not unique. In North Carolina, where which is a narrowly divided state, a little more Republican than Democrat, but it has a Democratic governor, Roy Cooper. Republicans need to pick up just a couple of seats in each chamber to be able to override Governor Cooper's vetoes. And then there's a couple of Republican states that have Democratic governors in Kansas, Louisiana, and Kentucky, where all three of those Democratic governors do face veto-proof Republican majorities. But none of those states, and even North Carolina, are not the sort of quadrennial presidential battleground that Wisconsin is, and none of them have quite the same reputation and record as being a 50-50 state as Wisconsin. That's what really makes Wisconsin stand out here, is that it is a state where Democrats have a record of winning statewide elections. In fact, have won 9 out of the last 10 statewide elections. And yet the state legislative map is so tilted toward Republicans that they are on the verge of winning 2/3 of the seats in both chambers.
Let's go back to our callers. Jimmy is with us in Valley Junction. Hey, Jimmy.
Afternoon, gentlemen. I'm hoping when the voters go and pull the lever tomorrow, however they vote, they think about when Walker and the Republicans had the full control, just how much authority they took away from local officials and school districts to fund what they thought locally was a good idea. Everything kind of emanated out of Madison, and that's the complaint that Michaels talks about, turning Madison upside down, whatever that means. And so I think that's what finally undone Walker when he got beat by Evers, is the people local level said, you know, we've had enough of this total control from Madison.
Jimmy, thanks for the call. What do you think, Reed?
Well, that's certainly a big complaint you hear, especially from Milwaukee. Now, the city of Milwaukee is without an infusion of funds from the state government, really is either going to have to make massive cuts to its services, particularly its police department, in the next couple of years, or it's going to wind up declaring bankruptcy. And that's a real fiscal ticking time bomb that's happening for the city and the state. And the Republicans who control the state legislature in Madison have not shown any real inclination to help solve that problem up to this point.
Thanks for the call. Harry joins us now in Rock Falls. Harry, hello.
Hello. My question is, what with Trump endorsing the write-in candidate in Robin Boss's district, do you think that might split the Republican vote and that actually the Democrat might win that district?
Harry, thanks for the call. I don't think there is actually a Democrat on the ballot. There's another write-in candidate. A tall order, even with a Donald Trump endorsement, read for a write-in candidate to overturn an incumbent like Robin Voss.
Yeah, you know, we've seen a lot of wacky things in the last few years during the Trump era. And you remember Robin Voss almost lost the primary to Adam Steen, who challenged him in the primary, now is running as a write-in candidate and has Trump's endorsement. But I guess I wouldn't bet too expensive a meal on that race, on Robin Voss being in a whole lot of trouble in that race.
Thanks for the call, Harry. Another thing you focus on in your piece, Reed, based on your reporting here in Wisconsin, the idea we hear again and again that more and more elections, even at the state or even local level, are still national issue elections. How much of a factor is that? We're focusing maybe more on big nationwide stuff instead of our local and state politics.
I mean, I think it's a big issue. You know, you think about the difference between now and even 10 or 15 years ago, how many people that don't get any, you know, don't get a local newspaper or don't have local radio stations because corporate ownership of those has, you know, cut away at the number of reporters that are available. You know, in Wisconsin, we've seen Gannett, the Gannett company, buy up most of the local daily newspapers and centralize the reporting and cut the number of journalists that exist in a lot of these communities. And so that's meant that there is just happens to be less news being reported in these places. And at the same time, people are getting more and more of their news from social media, which you know, we know about how people get siloed into their sort of political areas on Facebook and Twitter and elsewhere, and on cable news. People are watching Fox News. They're getting their, you know, broad Fox News or MSNBC or even CNN. They're getting broad swaths about national parties and less information about what's happening locally. And that, for a lot of these Democrats in rural areas, they are have told me that it really makes it difficult for them to explain that they're different from Joe Biden, whose approval rating is subterranean at this point. And it makes it so that they do a lot of explaining about what they're not and less about what they're for.
And you wrote it for some of these districts, especially those key districts in northern Wisconsin, maybe having to drive a couple few hours to do the local TV or newspaper interview.
That's right. And, you know, the newspapers in Superior and Ashland come out just a couple times a week. They have one or maybe two full-time reporters. They're in a TV market. The state Senate district cuts across TV markets in Wausau, Duluth, and Minneapolis. And so there's not going to be any attention paid to that from the local television stations. And it's, frankly, very expensive to get a message out. And so when the combination of all those things happening and the low news environment leads voters into their partisan corners.
Reed, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Hey, thank you. Happy to be on.
That's Reed Epstein, politics reporter for the New York Times, now formerly with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He talked with us about the possibility of Republicans winning a veto-proof majority in the Wisconsin legislature. Republicans would need to flip one seat in the state Senate and five in the Assembly in order to make that happen. Speaking of elections, voting day is tomorrow, and you can follow the results here on the Ideas Network. That's starting at 7 o'clock tomorrow night. Could be a long, slow process. They often are, but you can keep up with the latest developments tomorrow night here on the Ideas Network, or you can listen live online at WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. If you are looking to buy or sell a house or get a new mortgage, things have changed a lot over the course of the last year. Find out what's going on, get some advice, and maybe get some answers to your own questions if you call or email in. That's Mortgage and House Buying Talk tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. If you like seeing cool things in the night sky, I've got good news and bad news for you. Good news, overnight, Wisconsin can see a total lunar eclipse. That's the one where the moon is in Earth's shadow, and it looks cool. Bad news, as reported by NASA, the process starts just after 2 a.m. The full eclipse starts at about quarter after 4 a.m., with maximum coverage around 5 a.m. I'm pulled in both directions here. On the one hand, I'm a fan of lunar eclipses, really enjoyed the last couple I've seen. On the other hand, I am a fan of sleeping, and this all happens at a time when I'm usually sleeping. So I have to decide if I'm going to try to stay up all night for it or set my alarm super early. Partly cloudy tonight, that's an upside. Downside, low of 35, and it's going to be the last total lunar eclipse until 2015. I'll have this debate with myself during the day. If you end up watching it, let us know. Email your description, pictures, if any, to ideas@WPR.org. Nothing I could say, a total eclipse of the moon. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new Wisconsin-based initiative works to protect veterans at risk of suicide by giving them a place to voluntarily store their firearms. We'll hear from the Milwaukee VA and a police chief involved in the effort. Now, the upcoming winter holidays are a time when many people join together to share food and drinks. But for people who are staying sober, winter gatherings might add a level of stress or social anxiety about still participating while saying no to alcohol. Our guest today has advice on how to manage those social situations, and if you're the host, how to have options for your guests who opt not to drink for whatever reason. Tom Doofman is a licensed mental health provider specializing in OCD, anxiety, depression, relationship issues, and substance abuse disorders, and assistant director of counseling and psychological services at St. Norbert College. He's president of the nonprofit Section Sober in Brown County. Tom, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back.
Can you talk about the stress that can come with the holidays for people, you know, trying to stay sober, but knowing that there's likely going to be alcohol at that company party, family party, you name it?
Yeah, I think one of the things that goes along with the holidays is this expectation of celebration. And so some people choose not to drink, and there are a lot of reasons for that. It might be that they never really chose to drink in the first place, mm-hmm. or they have a health issue, or they've got some interest with being sober. But the idea is that just because everybody else is expecting you to consume alcohol, it doesn't mean that you have to.
Let's talk about advice for both ends of the equation, the guest and the host. Let's start with that guest who, for whatever reason, as you mentioned, doesn't want to drink, but knows there might be that expectation that everybody's probably going to drink. What are some tips you have for someone in that situation to get ready for that?
Well, lots of times, whoever's hosting the party will accept an answer that's given by the participant. So if you come to a party and you're not intending to drink, you can say something as basic as, you know, I'm driving tonight, or, you know, I don't like that taste of that particular liquor. And some might even say, you know, I'm feeling a little queasy, so I'm just taking it easy tonight. Others may even say something as basic as, you know, I'm allergic to alcohol. Somebody who's actually in recovery from alcohol or drugs might be willing to share that and say, hey, you know, I'm choosing not to drink. But the point is to be comfortable with the answer and realize that most people will take your casual response at face value, and they're not going to read into it more.
Let's flip things around that now. I'm the host. I don't want to have to like interrogate that guest just because they don't want to drink alcohol. How can we create a good setting where hopefully that conversation doesn't even have to happen?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I think the key is to have a lot of options. So having both alcoholic and non-alcoholic beverages readily available will be a signal to your guests that they do have the ability to choose. And especially in the past couple of years, mocktails have been a really popular option for folks to try so that you're not relegated to just having, you know, a bottle of water or some soft drink. So I think having options available and not pressuring anybody with their choice or choices is a good combination.
Now, for that person who is in recovery and is looking ahead at this event and maybe dreading it in particular as a threat to their recovery, you know, maybe it's old friends they used to drink with, or it's a stressful family scene and this is going to be a tempting moment. When do you suggest maybe giving it a miss this year?
Well, I think whenever you're at risk of injuring yourself, that's a good time to choose to step back. So a step ahead of that might be doing some proactive work and just mentioning to your family or to the host, hey, I'm choosing not to drink at this event. And if you're getting a lot of resistance, then maybe having a recovery person or a buddy that can support you, almost being your wingman at that event or at that family gathering. And if it's still not looking like it's going to be a worthwhile event, then it might be better to just avoid the situation at that time.
One thing I've run into, a friend of mine who is in recovery from alcohol in particular has a BYO plan. He shows up with his favorite ginger soda, and that's what he drinks. And the question doesn't come up because he has his soda. Nobody's going to offer him a drink. Is that a tactic you think would work for a lot of people?
Yeah, I think you can pre-plan by having your own beverage or, you know, when you get to the event, just taking a cup or a glass that's there and filling it with a beverage of your choice that is non-alcoholic. You know, the goal is to get through the event without drinking and at that time. And most other people at the party aren't going to be keeping track or questioning that. So it really loses some of that uncomfortableness, and having something in your hand is a great way to kind of get through that event. So your friend is a wise person.
And finally, Tom, the events themselves, the holidays, can be a tough time for people in recovery. Can you talk about ways that they can maybe tap into their support network, maybe a little extra this time of year?
Yeah, again, you know, just having the time change and it being more dark as well, and it being a super celebratory time, but people missing family or feeling alone, it can really compound folks that are trying to stay in recovery. So one of the silver linings of the post-pandemic era is that there are a lot of online meetings, so people can reach out and be connected to a 12-step meeting anytime throughout the day. Also, having a few people that you feel comfortable with just calling or checking in with, sending a text, knowing that they have your back is one of the things that will really help.
Tom, we'll leave it there. Thanks for sharing this advice with us today.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Tom Doofman, licensed mental health provider specializing in OCD, anxiety, depression, relationship issues, and substance abuse disorders, and assistant director of counseling and psychological services at St. Norbert College. Shared advice with us on how to stay sober during holiday events, avoid the peer pressure to drink, and if you're the host, to not put that pressure on people in the first place. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a culinary icon from Madison.
Carson Gully was a Black culinary, radio, and TV pioneer in the mid-1900s. Now, his legacy lives on at the University of Wisconsin-Madison after it named a dining venue after him. He's also known for his famous fudge bottom pies. But Scott Seaforth, an assistant director of residence life at University Housing, says that he's read more than 100 interviews with Gully, and not once did his now famous fudge bottom pies come up. He talked about this, plus Gully's adversity despite discrimination, on WPR's The Larry Miller Show.
Today, University Communications likes to talk up his fudge bottom pie all the time. And it's one of the only things people know him for, because it's like for 40 years, it's the only way almost that University Communications has presented him to the public in relationship to fudge bottom pie. And I've read over 100 interviews that he gave during his lifetime, and he never once mentions fudge bottom pie as anything that he's proud of. Not that he wasn't proud of it, but when you ask him the recipes that he was proudest of, that does not come up. Working with him was one of the best experiences that he had as for working with somebody, for his collegiality and how he treated people, and that his ability to do high quality food for large numbers was really extraordinary. And while he had high expectations, he also, what the output was extraordinary. This was the problem. In this era, an African-American man could never get advanced into a position where they would supervise white people. Even in 1950, when the university did an examination of all the African-Americans, there were like 300 or something African-Americans that worked at the university, only one of them was supervising people, and they had their staff was all people of color. And that was the only reason they were allowed to be a supervisor. So it didn't matter how good Gully was, he could never get the advancement that he deserved. But what he did do is he essentially ran the dining operation in what is now the building named after him, which was one of the main dining operations on the lakeshore. You know, Gully, when he moved here in 26, he just had a terrible time finding housing. There were restrictive covenants on deeds. You couldn't buy housing. African Americans could not buy housing except in several very small prescribed areas in Madison, none of which were by the university. So if you worked at the university, you wouldn't want to live where the city told African Americans to live. He would get rooms in apartment buildings, and then the white neighbors would circulate petitions, and he would be asked to leave. And that happened routinely for a series of years until finally he got an offer to go work elsewhere because he was tired of dealing with the housing problem. And this is 1936. And Don Halverson, the director of university housing, said that he'd fix this in the only way that he could, which is he built an apartment for Gully in a building next door to the building that Gully worked in the basement in Tripp Hall. And Gully moved into this apartment in this basement of Tripp Hall, and he lived there for the next 20 years. He continued to fight. This is the part of Gully's life that we tend to not tell in Madison is the way that he used his professional and his public stature to challenge, you know, the persistent practices of racial segregation and exclusion in that time. They had a cross burned in their yard. They had constant hate mail, phone calls. And it, even though they persisted, and they, it didn't mean that any other people of color moved in. And it did not change the laws in Madison at that time. In fact, Gully wouldn't live to see the change of the racial segregation laws in Madison.
WPR's Jonah Balekas produced that story on culinary pioneer Carson Gully. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we'll hear about a new initiative here in Wisconsin that aims to help protect veterans who are at risk of suicide. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. According to the group Stop Soldier Suicide, veterans are 57 more likely to be at risk of suicide than those who haven't served. A new Wisconsin-based program is working to support veterans at risk by protecting their firearms in an initiative called Live Today, Put It Away. The program works with the Delafield Police Department, the Southeastern Wisconsin Veteran Suicide Prevention Task Force, and the Captain John D. Mason Veteran Peer Outreach Program. Eric Kale is the Delafield Police Chief. Chief Kale, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Bert Berger is a clinical psychologist and division manager of mental health services for the Milwaukee VA. Dr. Berger, thanks for being with us.
Yes, happy to be here. Thanks.
Dr. Berger, let's start with you. Can you talk about the risk of suicide among veterans? I gave one statistic there. Can you talk a little more about that?
Yes, sure. So definitely the risk of suicide, or actually suicide completions, has been going up in this country, not only among veterans, but also among non-veterans. Really, since year 2000, the rate has been just continuing to climb. This past year, there may have been just a slight decrease, but still, it's about more than 6,000 suicide deaths by veterans across the country. So it's noted to be higher than in some of the non-veteran populations. And one of the things that I was looking into this. I've been at the VA in Milwaukee for 30 years and really much involved in clinical research or clinical care of veterans, and really was looking, could we do something at a public health level to make a difference in veteran suicide? So one of the statistics that I really was caught on was that firearms are the top way that people die from suicide. So 50% of deaths by non-veterans is using a firearm. In the veteran population, especially with men, about 70% of deaths from suicide are using a firearm. So there was a unique program called the Gun Shop Project, really developed by a gun shop in New Hampshire a number of years ago. And what had happened is that the gun shop owner found out in a six or seven day period, three people bought firearms from his gun shop, and they went out and killed themselves. So he was like, really, even as a gun shop owner, he wanted to do something. And he came up with the concept, like, perhaps gun shops or firearm or police stations, sheriff departments could hold on to a firearm for somebody that's in a crisis, but also to provide materials about the risk of suicide for veterans, non-veterans, anybody, that when they're buying a firearm, that they're aware of the high risk of death by suicide by having a firearm available. So access to lethal means like a firearm is really a crucial thing.
Now, Chief Kale, that's where you come into the story. We have gun shops participating in this project. You are, I understand, the first police department in the state to get involved. First of all, on a practical level, how does this work? How can someone who's worried work with your police department?
Sure. Well, starting out, we're open to Waukesha County residents. There was a concern that our meager resources might be tested further than we could hope to accommodate. So we're starting out with Waukesha County residents. But anyone, veteran or not, can come to the department if they're dealing with a crisis, and we will take their voluntary surrender of their firearm and store them here for a period of time, hopefully so that they can receive treatment.
And as you mentioned, Chief Kale, this is completely, this is voluntary.
Absolutely. Yeah. This is not a program to go seize guns. This is someone who thinks they might need some help, and we want to be there to help them.
And Chief Kale, you're, as I mentioned, you're the first police department. What is it about this program that appealed to you that made you say, yeah, we need to be on board with this?
Well, I've responded to way more, too many suicides during my career. And I'm always looking for a way to help impact that positively. One of our clerks at the department had run into somebody else from the organization. She came back and handed me some information, and I immediately wanted to be involved. Like I said, we've handled more suicides than I care to, including veterans. And if we can make a positive impact on that, I think we should.
And Dr. Berger, can you talk about the hopes that, so hopefully this veteran or non-veteran, as Chief Kale mentioned, they part with their guns for a while, they're in a secure place. Is it likely, are you hopeful that they can get treatment, get through this period, and then get to a point where they say, okay, I don't need to do this. I do feel safe having my gun around again.
Yeah, so that's really our goal, is that when a person is crisis, they tell someone about it and they get some help. And if someone asks them about the firearms, that they realize that that is probably one of the highest risks for dying by suicide. And then the idea would be to get the firearm in a safe place. It wouldn't have to be at a sheriff's department or police department or a gun shop. It could be with their family or friend or somebody to hold it and lock it up somewhere safe for them. But some people may be too proud or feel like they really don't want to tell family about this, and they would want to do it with somebody that's a little more independent. So the whole idea is that the time that they'd have to think about it may save their lives. Because a lot of times someone thinks of suicide, they're in a really down place. It only may be an hour or so or less that they then make that impulsive attempt. And with the firearm, there's not really any going back. So if they have time to think about it and can't get access to the firearm, that's where we're hoping that we're going to save lives.
Chief Kale, I know we have other law enforcement listeners from around the state who call in sometimes. If they're hearing this right now and saying, yeah, we should do this, what is your advice to them to get involved and get started on this?
My advice is to just do it. I'll share our policy, our process on how to implement and how to do it procedurally with any agency in the state, anywhere. I think this is important enough that it just needs to be shared and expanded upon.
And Dr. Berger, do we need more, both gun stores and police agencies? Do we have enough coverage on this program so far in the state?
Well, no, we don't. And that's really great that you're doing this program, because even making the program aware to the state is important, so that people are aware of it and can use it. So far for gun shops, we have 33 gun shops that have signed up. They are across the state, as far north. I'm looking at our map. We actually have a Google map on betherewis.com. And on the map, we have near Superior, and as far south as, I believe, Racine, Kenosha, and then across the state. But we only have one police station, so that's Delafield. So there are the first one have been willing to take the time and effort to do this. So we really would like to see more of them throughout the state. We're hoping to get, you know, at least one gun shop or sheriff or police department in every county, really is my goal for this project, so that we can cover the state of Wisconsin and have a robust program.
And Chief Kale, this is pretty new in Delafield and Waukesha County. How are you spreading the word so people know that this is available with your department?
Well, our reach for promoting these types of things is pretty limited. Mm-hmm. So an opportunity like this is fantastic. We use our social media as our means to broadcast special programs like this. But of course, that's limited. It's just the people that are viewing it. So I'm hoping word of mouth, I'm hoping opportunities like this will spread the seeds so that others will get involved.
Chief Kale, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
And Dr. Berger, thanks for being with us.
Yes, thank you so much for doing this.
We've been talking to Eric Kale, police chief for the Delafield Police Department, and Dr. Bert Berger with the Milwaukee VA. They joined us to talk about a new initiative. It's called Live Today, Put It Away, that works to help veterans at risk of suicide by providing safe places to store firearms when they feel like they're in a crisis moment. Search for that Live Today, Put It Away online. You can find more info. And if you or someone you know is at risk of suicide, you can contact the Veterans Crisis Line at 988 and then press 1.